I have been asked to introduce the speaker that Illini Union Student Activities is bringing tonight. As a member of this generation, I was probably brought up on what became known as the Bible. And the author of that Bible is here tonight. He has long been cast in a role of speaking about raising children. I think that it's very important that he's now concerned about what happens to the children that were brought up under his Bible. I'd like to introduce Dr. Benjamin Spock.
Thank you. What I want to do tonight is talk without pussyfooting about my views of some of the crucial issues of today. And then we'll get, after about half an hour, we'll get into questions and answers and challenges and violent disagreements, if you like to. If I speak flat-footedly, I would expect you to speak as flat-footedly in your questions. And let's say that at least the first three questions will be for people who strongly disagree or disapprove of what I'm saying. First, of course, is the war in Vietnam, and I want to just list the reasons why I think that that's an illegal and immoral war, as well as detrimental to the best interests of the United States and unwinnable. First of all, the United States was never invited in there, though Lyndon Johnson has tried to persuade the American people that we have a commitment or either to the people or to the CETO nations. No such thing. It was the idea of our government under Eisenhower and John Foster Dulles to try to occupy the power vacuum that was left when the French were defeated after 8 years war in which they tried to reimpose colonial rule on Vietnam, and the Vietnamese people eventually overwhelmingly defeated them. That war was ended by the Geneva Accords, which specified, among other things, that no foreign nation was to interfere politically or militarily, and that within 2 years, and this was 1954, within 2 years, the people of both the North and South sections, which were never a separate country but were just divided for armistice purposes temporarily, were to vote to reunite under any government that they wanted. And our representatives at the Geneva Conference signed a separate statement agreeing that we would not interfere in any way. We didn't interfere. We began promptly to interfere. We found our first puppet, Diem, in the United States, transported him to Vietnam and installed him. And it's been pointed out by a number of people, we might have gotten away with this if we'd happened to choose a more democratic or at least a more popular kind of dictator. But we chose one of the most tactless and tyrannical people of modern times, who not only with our connivance canceled the elections that were promised, he also canceled the village elections that had always been a feature of Vietnamese life. He filled the jails to overflowing, turning more and more suspicious, tossing more and more people into jail as time went on. And most tactless of all, in an agricultural nation, he took the land that had been given by Ho Chi Minh at the time Ho Chi Minh controlled four-fifths of the country north and south, the land that Ho Chi Minh had taken away from the absentee landlords and given to the peasants. Our puppet Diem took it away from the peasants and gave it back to the absentee landlords who lived in such cities as Saigon. I think it's important to remember that there's a strong class structure in Vietnamese life, that there's a small Mandarin class of landowners, army officers. These were the people who fought on the side of the French against their own people when the Vietnamese people were winning their independence from the French, and these are exactly the same people who've been on our side, and roughly speaking, there's nobody else on our side except a few profiteers. So this is the first illegality. We broke our promise not to interfere, and we interfered outrageously for our own benefit. Then the second illegality was that when the Viet Cong revolt broke out in 1960, We should, according to our promises to the UN, when there is a threat to the peace, we should have referred the whole dispute immediately to the UN. And we failed to do so, thereby breaking our promise by international law to the UN. Then in February 1965, when Lyndon Johnson suddenly escalated the war, let me break off there just a minute and say, you remember that Goldwater had suggested during the 64 campaign that the way to end the trouble there was for the United States to escalate the war, and Lyndon Johnson was the peace candidate who said that he was flatly opposed to escalation or sending American boys to fight there. When Lyndon Johnson suddenly escalated the war by extending the bombing to North Vietnam and beginning the introduction of fighting troops to the number of, eventually, of over 500,000 now, he broke his promise to obey the Constitution of the United States that says only Congress can declare war. Lyndon Johnson has said all along that the Tonkin Gulf Resolution was the equivalent, but it isn't the equivalent. There's no mention in the Constitution of a Tonkin Gulf Resolution. More seriously, I believe that it's not too strong a statement to make that the Tonkin Gulf Resolution was extracted from Congress by fraudulent statements on the part of the Johnson administration. You remember Johnson told Congress when he wanted this resolution empowering him to take all necessary action to repel aggression, he said flatly that this was unprovoked attack by the North Vietnamese naval forces against our naval forces. Well, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee under William Fulbright has shown that it was no such thing. The United States naval forces had trained and equipped a South Vietnamese naval force which was making an attack on a North Vietnamese naval installations in a North Vietnamese harbor with the knowledge of our Navy and with the cooperation of our Navy, that our naval forces in communication with the South Vietnamese force were steaming offshore and to the north in a northeasterly direction to try to draw the North Vietnamese naval forces off so the South Vietnamese force would meet less opposition when it went into that harbor. Now, our government, unable to win the war, despite its overwhelming superiority in number of troops and even more overwhelming superiority in equipment, basically because the people are all on the other side. I don't mean that they're necessarily very active. All of them are active partisans, but they certainly all resent the effort of a foreign country to impose its dictator on them and are either actively or passively on the other side from us. Unable to win for this reason, our government has resorted to wholesale breaking of the law, international laws regarding the laws of war. These are the Hague Conventions and the Geneva Conventions, to which the United States has subscribed its name. We have been deliberately destroying crops in order to starve out the South Vietnamese people. This is forbidden by international law to which we have subscribed. We have been destroying dwellings in South Vietnam, both by bombing and by setting the torch to them. This is forbidden by international law. We have taken the people in the hundreds of thousands as a result of our search and destroy missions and have put them into camp where they are living in many of them, an unutterable squalor. This is forbidden by international law to remove civilian populations and put them into camps. In North Vietnam, where our government keeps claiming that all we're bombing is strategic targets, meaning military installations, bridges, roads, actually the evidence is overwhelming, brought back by Americans who visited North Vietnam and by neutral people, shown in Felix Green's movie in North Vietnam. We have been deliberately destroying all the villages and cities of North Vietnam. If you see Felix Green's movies, you see city after city that all the dwellings have been leveled, and Felix Green at least is the authority for the statement that there never has been anything of any military significance there. We've also been using anti-personnel bombs in North Vietnam, which would have no usefulness against military targets at all. Pellet bombs and steel sliver bombs, whose only purpose is to tear flesh off bones and terrorize people. Now, the next point that I would like to make is I certainly am convinced that our war in Vietnam is not an isolated incident. It's not a mistake. This is part of America's power expansion, particularly since World War II. The United States ended World War II incomparably the world's strongest power, and there were power vacua around the world. I was thinking of how President Eisenhower himself, the year before the French collapse in 1953, was addressing the governors of the American states, and he was explaining to them why the United States had been, throughout the 8 years of the French War, why it had been that the Vietnamese war to get independence from the French. He was trying to explain to them why the United States had paid 80% of the French expenses for that war throughout those 8 years. And he said, it isn't because we love the French people so down there. He said, it's because there's such valuable materials in that part of the world. And he mentioned tin and tungsten and other valuable things that we need to control. The United States, since World War II, has had in military installations on foreign soil, over 3,000 such installations in 30 foreign countries. I doubt whether the British Empire ever had such a widespread web of military installations. The United States industries since World War II, because of their ingenuity, their effectiveness, their efficiency, have expanded into European countries, Canada, Great Britain, to such an extent that from time to time there is distress expressed in the parliaments of these countries, that they feel anxiety about having so much of their industry be branches of American industry. They fear more specifically that if there were a recession in the United States, that American industries might favor United States branches to the disadvantage of their branches in Europe and Canada, and that this might precipitate a more acute depression in these other countries. The United States with foreign aid, military and non-military aid, actually exerted political control on other countries, even communist Yugoslavia. To such a degree, for instance, that Great Britain the Labour government in Great Britain is unable to criticize and dissociate itself from United States policy in Vietnam, which is very offensive to a majority of the Labour members of Parliament, because we have the power to throw Great Britain into bankruptcy, and I myself would suspect that Lyndon Johnson would have no hesitancy in telling that to Prime Minister Wilson, or doing it if Prime Minister Wilson tried to defy him. It's even more pointed, the inability of the Indian government, which much more resents our presence and our killing in Vietnam, because India, also an Asian nation, and having fierce sensitivity to colonialism, the government of India is unable to express openly its objection to our policy in Vietnam. They grind their teeth a little, they make mutterings, it comes out in interviews occasionally, but they always, Madame Gandhi always has to say something sweet afterwards, because again, our government could throw the government of India almost into a bankruptcy. They are that dependent on our financial aid. In addition, as you know, United States power has been spread by the CIA. Shortly after World War II, the CIA succeeded in overthrowing a popular government in Iran. A few years later, it tried to overthrow a popular government in Indonesia. During the Eisenhower administration, the CIA boasted in a quiet way, and President Eisenhower boasted in a quiet way, that the CIA overthrew a popularly elected government in Guatemala. There aren't too many popularly elected governments in Latin America. This government came to power on, won an election on promises that they would institute land reform. The peasants there are miserably poor. There was a promise by this government to divide up the estates and give them to the impoverished peasants. But the United Fruit Company is by far the largest landowner in Guatemala, and the United Fruit Company has the Eisenhower administration have the CIA overthrow that government, and it was supplanted by a military dictatorship of the kind that our government seems to feel much more comfortable in getting along with. We did very much the same thing in Cuba, though it was a miserable failure. You know, for years, our government, our military, and our industries had been getting along very nicely with the Batista dictatorship, a cruel, oppressive military dictatorship. And then somehow or other, Castro succeeded, starting with a small guerrilla band, succeeded and eventually in overthrowing that regime. Most Americans have forgotten that one of the first things that Castro did after his triumph was to come to New York, where he received a ticker tape parade. There's always been controversy about whether Castro was a communist all the time, or whether he later espoused communism in order to get along, to get those loans from the Soviet Union and help from China. Certainly is not standard operating communist procedure for a man who's won a communist victory to come to the United States and New York for a ticker tape parade. The next thing that Castro did, since he had promised to nationalize the sugar industry and other industries, since the people of Cuba were miserably poor and the only solution from Castro's point of view was to nationalize those industries, he wanted a loan in order to pay back American owners of to pay back Americans who own part of the sugar plantations of Cuba and other industries there. Castro went down to Washington. He wanted to be received by President Eisenhower, and Eisenhower said he didn't want to see him. Then he asked whether he could come and see Secretary of State Herter at the State Department, and Herter said, "Don't come to the State Department. I'll come to your hotel room." And so Herter came to Castro's hotel room, asked for the loan, and was turned down on the loan. And then he nationalized these industries anyway, felt he absolutely had to, and there was immediate talk in the United States Senate and the House that we ought to go in and, without any legal basis at all, and overthrow this upstart who interferes with American industry. The CIA, as you know, made a miserably botched attempt. It was an absolute fiasco, but certainly our government was trying in a slightly veiled way to bring about another revolution, to get rid of the popular government and get back to one with which we could deal more comfortably. The same thing happened in regard to the Dominican Republic. The United States military, industry, and the administration had for years been getting along in a very comfortable, cordial way with one of the cruelest dictatorships of Latin America in the Dominican Republic. And when there was a popular revolt in that same fateful spring of 1965, within a few days, the American ambassador cabled to Washington that he feared a, after this revolt started, a popular revolt started, social revolt. He said he was afraid that communists were going to take over. And Lyndon Johnson landed 20,000 of our troops promptly. And we succeeded in changing the leadership to at least a less radical one. When the actual count of communists in the Dominican Republic was made, it was found that there were 26 communists in the Dominican Republic, 13 of whom were already in jail. So it was hardly a plausible, or at least as an excuse, it didn't hold much water. Now, in saying these things, I want to make it absolutely clear that I'm not saying that I think that the United States is worse than any other country. I think that fascist countries do this sort of thing when they feel that they can get away with it. Royalist countries in the past did it when they felt that they could get away with it. Communist countries have done the same thing, the same kind of thing, when they thought they could get away with it. I'm not saying that Americans are worse. I'm only saying American governments are just as bad as other governments. And our government conceals from itself its imperialism, its at times very ruthless imperialism, and conceals it from the American people by saying that it's out to contain communism. Now, I believe in containing communism or any other kind of government that is threatening to overthrow a government with whom we have an alliance, especially if that government is backed by the people. I thought that the United States was right in when Stalin seemed in an expansionistic phase after World War II. I thought we were right to get into the NATO, to build the NATO alliance and the Marshall Plan to stem that or to challenge that expansiveness. And I, at the time of the Korean War, felt that the United States was right. I felt at that time that the United States was right with the UN to go to the aid of South Korea when it was invaded by North Korea. So that I'm not opposed to standing up to communism or any other kind of government when it really is aggression. But what I'm objecting to, and what I think that the American people, if they're ever going to get a more peaceful world, a juster, governments that are more just and more concerned with the needs of the people in such areas as Latin America, Americans have got to stop throwing their weight around in such aggressive, ruthless ways and then calling it standing up to or containing communism. When you press Lyndon Johnson or Dean Rusk to the wall, when a journalist does, saying, just why is it necessary for the United States to have lost 27,000 dead in South Vietnam, to have wounded 150,000 Americans, to have killed at least a million Vietnamese and half destroyed that country? How can that small country be that important? They always fall back to it's China that we really feel, and it's China that's trying to control Southeast Asia. I think there are two answers to that. One is that the United States has always claimed the right to have a predominant influence in the Western Hemisphere. This is exactly what our Monroe Doctrine is. I learned in school, in grade school, that the Monroe Doctrine was a noble, protective gesture on the part of the United States that was going to protect those poor, weak countries from being gobbled up by evil European countries. But more recently, had my eyes open and realized, this is an imperialist claim. We were telling the countries of Europe, keep your hands off. We want to be the country that dominates Latin America. And this is what we have been doing ever since. And we've had imperialist adventures in Mexico on several occasions. We stole 40% of Mexico at the time that we turned that into our southwestern states. We were doing the same kind of thing in the Spanish-American War in 1898. We had troops in Nicaragua from time to time. This is American imperialism, of course, and this is why we're so suspected and hated in Latin America. What I'm saying is that I'm not making these points to be kind to other countries. I'm not saying that our government must be nice to other countries, though that's part of it. If you're going to live in the world just like an individual living in a community, I think the only sound basis is respect for the rights and the dignity of other people. But I think that more importantly, what I'm talking about is the safety of our country. If our country goes on hurling itself into country after country where it thinks its imperial interests are threatened, and let me interject here, we have Green Beret paratroopers, Green Beret troops in, not paratroopers, Green Beret troops in most of the Latin American dictatorships at the present time, teaching anti-guerrilla warfare tactics to the armies of these military dictatorships. In other words, we're already anticipating social revolts, which I believe and many people believe are inevitable in Latin America. We're already involved in anticipation. And what I and people who feel like me fear is that as soon as a revolt breaks out, we will back that up with more troops and more involvement. And then the fear is that frustrated in such a place as Vietnam, we will, in a frantic kind of a way, keep expanding the war, unable to succeed on a smaller scale, unable to, fearing that we will lose face, unable to admit that we're losing because the people are against us, always this tendency to escalate the war. And incidentally, this is what I particularly dread about the next 4 years, that when Richard Nixon and I assume that the polls are right and he's going to be our next president, what scares me most of all is the fear that he, who's always been a hawk about this war, is going to try at least temporarily escalating the war, feeling that maybe Lyndon Johnson hasn't given a good enough twist to the arm of the Vietnamese. My own feeling is that Lyndon Johnson has gone just as far as he dared in his ruthlessness, and that he thought that going further might bring China or the Soviet Union into the war. Well, I want to shift over here and talk just for a minute about racial injustice. This is certainly our second problem and a tragic problem in our country. For 350 years, we've been discriminating against, abusing, humiliating black people. And human beings are so constituted, if they don't see the slightest hope on the horizon, they suppress their fury and take the domination. But when they begin to see hope, then they begin to ask for a little and begin to allow themselves to feel the anger that they've been suppressing all the way along. And this, of course, is what has happened since the Supreme Court decision of 1954 and the successful sit-ins in the South carried out by brave young black people. And another thing that gave black people hope for a while was the anti-poverty program, the OEO, which I was on the advisory board of for a while when I was still friends with Lyndon Johnson. And the whole idea of OEO was to experiment with different techniques to see what would be effective in reducing poverty. And of course, the poverty program overlaps very much with the problem of black people. The whole idea was when the good techniques were found, to double, quadruple, multiply by 10 the amount of funds that were to go into anti-poverty. And there was bold talk of ending poverty in a relatively few years' time, and I believe that it could have been done. Two things happened, though. One, of course, was that the war in Vietnam was escalated, and we're now spending $30 billion a year, and this removes most of the money that could have been used for anti-poverty and gives Congress the excuse for not appropriating what could be appropriated in such a program. The other thing that's happened is that the municipal political machines in most of the cities of the United States insisted on getting control of how that money was spent, and this has also lowered the effectiveness of what funds there are available. Now, black people, having had their hopes aroused, are now getting increasingly furious, and since the more moderate leaders haven't been able to get anything of substance for them. And I really mean can't get much of substance, that though there have been some legal advances and a little help here and there for this or that group, the average black man in America is still living in as dilapidated a ghetto. His children are still going to third, fourth-rate schools. He's still being discriminated in his job choice in most places. Now, the black people allowing themselves to feel their rage are turning more toward more radical, more militant leaders. This, of course, gets us into the next topic, which is law and order. We've heard an awful lot about law and order in recent months, and it's sickening to me that the three leading presidential candidates, some of whom ought to know better, are competing with each other in saying that they're for law and order. Of course, all of us are for law and order as long as it's based on justice, but it is entirely inappropriate for those who have things going their way to insist that those who are being very unjustly deprived respect the law and order of those who are in charge, when those who are in charge could be dispensing justice if they had the decency to do so. Well, we're going to get a president who's going to keep talking about law and order, and I think that we who understand, among other things, that the Declaration of Independence spelled out very specifically that if people feel mistreated, they first try, these aren't the words of the Declaration of Independence, they first try polite ways, they first try legal ways. But the Declaration of Independence says if you can't get justice, then you're entitled to rebel if necessary in order to get it. And it's one of the blindnesses of American people that they keep shouting law and order when there are these spontaneous riots without either remembering that the black people are still being abused and without realizing that this is part of our Declaration of Independence. This is how we got free from England. I think it's important for us to remember that this is how the governments of France and England 1,000 years ago changed from absolute monarchies gradually to democracies. If the people of those countries and the people of the United States had all along been able to be silenced by their rulers telling them, remember now, law and order, France and England would still be absolute monarchies and the United States would be a colony of an absolute monarchy. It's time for us to wake up and realize that we have no right to keep talking to this way to black people, and that we've black people choose at the present time, or the most militant ones, to try to work things out their own way in their own neighborhoods, and I don't think we are in a position to tell them whether we think that's wise or not. Since we haven't given them what was their due, I think that we have to keep our mouths shut and let them use whatever methods they think are appropriate. But there's lots that white people could be doing, and the black people keep reminding us of this. We could be changing the law. We could be changing the climate in our localities. We could be changing the attitude of our real estate agents, our stores, and so on. And I think it's time that we did it. There's always that question of the talk about violence that people like Cleaver, at least in some sentences, use. I'm absolutely convinced that our press is misquoting and abbreviating and concentrating those violent statements, like the one in Newsweek magazine a couple of weeks ago, when it was certainly sounded terribly frightening, I think, to most white people. I've talked to many people who know Cleaver and have heard him give those talks, and this is a very unfair selection. I don't think that any Cleaver or anybody else who's sensible as a black leader is really talking about rebellion at the present time. What they're trying desperately to do is to tell the white people of America that their people, they aren't going to put up with this indefinitely, and are trying to signal us in a way that we can hear. And it's shocking that there's no real evidence that a majority of the American people are willing to grant them justice. In fact, the polls show clearly that a majority of Americans insist that black people continue to be deprived of justice. Then very briefly, I want to mention poverty, which I got into before. I feel there's no reason at all why the United States has to allow poverty to go on. As the richest country in the world, we should at least be able to bring our poor people up to the level that they've been brought to in Scandinavian countries where there's no such disorganization and humiliation as the poor have to put up with in the United States. The United States has good education in some schools, good education for some in universities, but there are many schools that are second, third, fourth rate. There's no excuse for this. We need a lot more colleges and universities at the present time than we've gotten, and there's no reason why the richest country in the world should not be providing those. We need better medical care. Well-to-do in most places get good medical care. Those who happen to live next to the finest university clinics get good medical care, but there are lots of Americans who don't get good medical care. We have this crazy situation for years, up until 2 years ago when we finally got Medicare, which is nothing more than hospitalization insurance for old people who can't afford to pay hospitalization insurance. You had the American Medical Association crying out that this would destroy the quality of medical care in the United States and that it would be an opening wedge to socialism and communism. Absolute tommy rot and fantastic that... that when all European countries and Canada were way ahead of us in providing better medical care for the people generally, that the AMA and conservatives in Congress could go on mouthing this kind of stuff. Where do we go from here? I myself am, in one sense, discouraged about the prospect for the next 4 years. Seems to me from reading what Nixon has said about the war, that he doesn't understand the war or what's going on in the world, and it seems to me perfectly clear that he doesn't understand what's going on in the United States. He has said very specifically that a sterner application of the law is the answer to unrest in our cities and that anti-poverty programs are not the appropriate thing. I am encouraged, of course, by one thing, and tremendously encouraged, and this is the idealism and the courage of American young people, at least a minority of them, and I think it's getting to be nearer a majority at the present time. I've just been speaking on behalf of the Civil Liberties Legal Defense Fund that's been raising funds for not only the Boston Four, but for young men generally who are in the toils of the law about the draft. I've spoken in the last 3 weeks in 15 colleges and universities in California and Colorado, and everywhere I went, the auditoriums were full to bursting, and three-quarters of the students, as far as I could tell from the applause, were on my side, and I think that this is the only thing that keeps me going. For 6 years, I've been in the peace movement and wandering around the country trying to rouse people to the danger of nuclear annihilation and fallout, always the same small size, mildly dispirited, middle-of-the-road, middle-aged audiences. And even after the war in Vietnam became escalated, the numbers didn't go up. I would have gone off and found a place in the southern hemisphere where the fallout will be less and just sailed a boat in my what's called the declining years. I've been given a new lease on life by finding that there are so many young people who say, why do we have to live in a rotten world like this when we've got the stuff to fix it up? I've also been very pleased to find they were on my side. You know, I used to think that since I was, at least in a bookish way, an advisor of their parents, and I assumed that their parents had always been quoting me at them, you have to wear galoshes when there's snow and things like that, that they would think that I was their enemy because of being on their parents' side. And one of the most marvelous things is to find that since I've been indicted and convicted, this is what has brought me close to the young people of America. Okay, I'd like first the three pretty critical questions. They can't be just neutral questions. I want to give, since I've been speaking outrageously, provocatively, I would like to give three people the chance to get back at me. You have to wave your hand fairly obviously because I can't see. Yes, here. Beg pardon? I could hear you, I just didn't catch it. He says, do I think the wealth of this country came as a result of our foreign policy? I think it's a small part of the wealth. The fact is, one of the reasons why, of course, our industries and financial institutions are so interested in having American industry in foreign countries, in